Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We begin this hour with news of political scandal in Olympia. This time it is State Representative Graham Hunt of Orting in Pierce County. He has resigned from the legislature over allegations he lied about his military record. Hunt calls them inconsistencies. How often do people lie about their military records, and why? We'll find that out in a moment. First, Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins has the facts for us. Austin, what did Representative Graham Hunt allegedly lie about?
Well, allegedly he embellished or perhaps lied about his military service. And I certainly need to note that this was a story that Jim Bruner in the Seattle Times broke last month. There's been follow-on reporting by several other media outlets, including the Tacoma News Tribune, sort of his hometown, or at least home county newspaper. But we know that he served in the Arizona National Guard. Where things seem to have gone sideways for him is that he claimed to have been a combat veteran of the conflicts in Iraq and in Afghanistan. He claimed that he had been awarded three military medals that Jim Bruner and other reporters couldn't confirm he had in fact earned, and he couldn't in fact prove he had earned. And then there was one recent development this week where he alleged to have been said that he had been shot and stabbed while in combat. This was in a private post, social media post. Again, he hasn't been able to confirm those injuries.
And what about evidence? What's the strongest evidence that he at least embellished?
Well, I think what first caught people's eyes was that there was a photo, I wouldn't call it an iconic photo, but perhaps a notable photo of two soldiers hugging that apparently was doctored and put on Facebook. And Hunt said in a Facebook post that that was a picture of him after, I believe, an IED blast. It wasn't him. That has been made very clear. He has said, or at least told the Seattle Times, that a campaign volunteer actually posted in his name on Facebook claiming that. But that really became, if you will, the iconic image in this scandal, which is here he is saying, that's me in the photo, and it isn't him.
So to repeat, it's not established that he lied.
You know, this is complicated. Part of the complication is that apparently a service member's record of awards and medals isn't always kept by the service or the branch that they serve for. It's something that they may have possession of, but you can't just go to a third party and get confirmation of. It's also true that a lot happens in war, right? You know, nobody was there with him. He was apparently dropping into units that he wasn't a permanent member of. Nobody has come out to say, hey, I was there and he wasn't there, as we've seen in other cases. And also many years have passed. So it is muddy, it's complex, but it clearly was enough for him to step down.
Yeah, so we're going to say more about that in a moment with someone from the Military Times Hall of Valor. Meanwhile, the case of this, again, Graham Hunt, Republican lawmaker from Orting, he's leaving the legislature. Who was calling for his resignation and why?
You know, I'm not sure that there were necessarily overt calls for his resignation, but these questions have been swirling for a couple of weeks now, and it's clear he was getting pressure internally to either come up with some good answers real quick or step out of the way. This was becoming a detraction for his Republican caucus in the House. You know, keep in mind that the House Republicans are very close to potentially gaining the majority in the House. All they have to do is pick up a couple of seats in the next election. They don't want anything that is going to be a distraction from their mission, if you will. There's some, you know, military discipline around this towards trying to claim the majority after many, many years of being in the minority. So that's part of what's going on. And it also is stolen valor is a very touchy subject, especially in an environment where you've got other military veterans in the legislature who are serving alongside him in the legislature. So I think he was feeling a lot of internal pressure to clear this up or get out of the way.
So he's getting out of the way. What work is Hunt best known for this session in the legislature?
Well, I got to be honest with you, Bill. I don't think I've met him. He's a relatively new member of the legislature, appointed first to fill a seat and then elected on his own right 2 years ago. But he's drawn some attention. He recently went to Oregon with another state legislator on a, quote, fact-finding mission having to do with this occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. He's clearly a conservative Republican and sort of part of that more freedom caucus group here. He also was the prime sponsor of a bill to repeal this rule that allows transgender individuals to access the bathroom or locker room of their choice. He had also proposed legislation to repeal the state's voter-approved background check law for guns. So pretty conservative issues and controversial issues that he got behind.
How common are Olympia scandals that lead to resignations?
I think we're sort of like on a one every 3 years average, although the last one was just last year. A House Republican, Susan Fagan from Eastern Washington, resigned because of allegedly fudged expense reports. Going back to my 13 years here, we've seen this from time to time. There was a member who resigned in the midst of a sex scandal having to do with an official trip to Spokane. Another member who resigned mysteriously and later said that he had an alcohol problem. It happens from time to time. But it's not that common.
Austin Jenkins, Olympia correspondent. Thank you, Austin.
You're welcome.
And we'll follow what happens to Graham Hunt's vacant seat in Olympia as well. Once again, Graham Hunt of Ording announcing his resignation. As I said, none of these allegations have been proven in Representative Hunt's case. But how common is it for people to lie about or exaggerate their military service? Doug Sterner curates the Military Times Hall of Valor, the biggest database of military award recipients. He has spent years documenting fraudulent claims of military service, and he says it's a major problem.
It has been for decades, but it's becoming increasingly at the forefront of much of what we do today.
You know, we as a society value our military heroes so much. Why would somebody lie about their military service?
Because it gets them something that they want, whether it's the guy in Texas who got the number two position at Texas A&M University with a six-figure salary based on lies, or whether it's the guy that's getting $3,500 a month tax-free from the VA based upon his false claims. It gets people something that they want.
How do people in the military community view this issue of people puffing up their military records?
Well, now, you use the term puffing up. Everybody in the military community puffs up their military records a little bit. We all tell war stories. I've done it. We all do it. There's a vast difference. If you say you were outnumbered 10 to 1 when you're only outnumbered 5 to 1, why, that's a war story. If you say, I got wounded 3 times and earned a Silver Star and you didn't, that's a lie.
Given what you know about Washington State's lawmaker, Representative Hunt, do you think he's lying?
I think it's a witch hunt.
A witch hunt?
That's probably not the answer you expected from me. Well, number one, in comparison with the stolen valor cases I've dealt with, this seems like a real minor thing. Now, let me tell you up front, I'm a Democrat. I disagree with him politically on everything. I'm not a Ted Cruz fan, but I think that somebody's got an agenda beyond stolen valor and going after him.
You think what we know about Graham Hunt's record, it's the kind of thing that as a society we ought to let that war story go?
Well, the only thing that really concerns me with him was that photograph. That is the thing that is the most stark thing that stands out to me, the photograph that was purportedly of him.
This is a photo, I think, that he posted on social media, but it involved a soldier that wasn't even him. And the line included suggested that this is something that that happened to him and he'll never forget.
Yeah. And, that bothers me. That was pretty cut and dry. The thing that I don't know is, did he post that? Was he aware of it? Or is it possible that a staffer did it? And compared with the gal that was speaking last Veterans Day in Arizona to school children wearing a Silver Star that she supposedly got in Vietnam, it seems like it's small potatoes to me.
You're right. There's much we don't yet know about Representative Hunt's case.
Exactly.
But shouldn't we care about even exaggeration our politicians?
Lyndon Johnson wore a Silver Star on his uniform all the time that he sat in the White House, and the circumstances behind that Silver Star are very, very sketchy, and he probably did not deserve it, but, those things happen. I am more concerned about the fact that we have very few veterans serving in public office today. But I understand it because the minute that a veteran runs for public office, everything that they say becomes a matter of fodder for veterans on the other side, whether it's a Democrat running and the Republicans pile on him, or a Republican running and the Democrats piling on him. This is becoming a political football that's going to discourage veterans from running for public office.
Well, let me ask you about that. Well, if we want more truth, accuracy, transparency around military service records, how do you think we could get at this in a better way?
Well, there's really no real good way to do it right now. Since 1975, the military record keeping has changed dramatically. There are 8 U.S. Navy SEALs out there today wearing Navy crosses on their uniform, and there is no paperwork to back it up, but they are legitimate recipients. And so, especially in the global war on terrorism, the awards system and record keeping and the excuse of classified operations has really muddied the waters, and I'm inclined to give veterans the benefit of the doubt. I would rather see 10 phonies get kudos for something that they never did than to mistakenly accuse a legitimate veteran and legitimate hero of something I can't prove.
That's Doug Stirner, curator of the Military Times Hall of Valor, reacting to Representative Graham Hunt resigning his seat effective yesterday after those questions over his representation of his military record. State law says that Graham Hunt must be replaced by another Republican. This is KUOW's The Record. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Good afternoon. Washington State has a teacher shortage. Public school leaders are calling it a crisis, but it's been a slow build. Washington's Teacher of the Year, Tacoma's Nate Gibbs Bowling, says he knows why we're short on teachers.
Over the last few years, policymakers have made being a teacher really difficult, and being a teacher has become a position that some people see as being less desirable. A lot of teachers have their work dictated to them and feel like they don't have autonomy. And if you compound that with not being treated like a professional and low pay, it's kind of a no-brainer.
A no-brainer. Well, one possible solution to the teacher shortage comes from your governor. Jay Inslee wants to roll back some tax breaks he says are no longer necessary and use that money to give teachers modest raises.
Frankly, it's more important to have a good first-grade teacher for a first grader than some of these tax breaks for the oil industry that have really outlived their usefulness.
Yes, you want to end a tax break that benefits oil refineries, a break in the real estate excise tax. You want some people who don't live here to pay more of our sales tax, and you want to take away the sales tax exemption for bottled water, right?
Right, and this is an investment, and these are reasonable ways to pay for this investment. Frankly, sometimes people want to just, either put this on a deficit or raid some other fund. Look, we can't raid the mental health budget. We can't raid the housing budget. We got to find a way to make this investment for our children. And I believe having a good teacher in every classroom is a good investment fundamentally. And those investments that I have proposed are more important than some of these special interest tax breaks that some lobbyists got 20 or 30 years ago that no longer even fit today's circumstances, particularly this oil and gas one. It was meant for the wood products industry. And now the oil industry is using about 90% of it. It wasn't even meant for this industry originally when it was conceived.
Republicans have other ideas for solving the teacher shortage. Representative Magandaz has a bill to increase recruitment and retention of teachers. What do you think of that?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what his plans are there, but I do know that when you're losing 50% of the teachers, we have these, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed new teachers. They're highly motivated to come in and teach. And then, they eat macaroni and cheese and live four to an apartment for 3 or 4 years, and then they go to work for Amazon or Microsoft or Boeing or someone else. And we just can't be competitive for these folks. We've got to give them a living wage. And they, frankly, don't have it earlier in their careers right now.
People talk about easing the certification requirements.
I guess that would not be my first path. There may be some things we can do to expedite certification processes. I don't think reducing quality of our teachers is the direction we want to go. And we're talking about reasonable levels of compensation here. So I think that we have to recognize that we are in a competitive market. And it's interesting, we're seeing this throughout state government. We have a robust economy. In fact, Business Insider magazine last week named us the number one economy in the whole United States, number one growth. We're having tremendous economic growth. And when that happens, the public sector and teachers now have to compete with, you know, businesses that are on a hiring spree right now. And this is why we're seeing this increasing pressure on our teacher corps and others, state patrolmen and some others, as a matter of fact. This is a symptom of a good economy.
Talking with Governor Inslee, the state Supreme Court says the state needs to pay teachers more. If Republicans won't raise taxes by ending these tax breaks, how will the state raise teacher pay?
Well, this is, look, the state's paramount duty is the education of our children. It's our first duty. It's paramount, has a meaning in the state constitution. The Supreme Court has recognized that. And it's a paramount duty of, you know, of moms and dads and grandmas and uncles and aunts as well. So this ought to be something we attend to first. And again, if you don't have a teacher in your classroom, you're hardly meeting the paramount duty of the state of Washington. So this ought to be a state responsibility. And it needs to be a state responsibility because then it has a more level educational opportunity for kids across the state. You know, it's a lot harder for Coppenish or a Sunnyside to pay for the education from their local community than a Mercer Island or a Bainbridge Island. And if we're going to have equal opportunity for all students so that every student, no matter where you live, if you're a rich or poor district, you still get a great education, the state needs to step up to the plate here. And that's why I'm pushing this right now. And I think, you know, we got some chance of success here.
We've got a short session here, Governor. Is this going to pass? And if not, what's Plan B?
It should pass, and there's no reason it can't pass. It is a short session, but we're thinking about our short kids, and they have a short time to be young, and they get one shot at education, and putting them off another year or two just doesn't cut it. You get one chance to be a first grader, and that first grader deserves a teacher in the classroom, and I'm bound and determined to get them one. That's what I'm up to here.
That's Governor Jay Inslee thinking about our short kids and proposing a solution to the teacher shortage. He wants to pay teachers more, and the money would come from ending some state tax breaks. We'll follow that through the legislature for you, and you'll find more KUOW coverage of our state teacher shortage and more education coverage at our website, KUOW.org. Kent is a place where you can find a steady job making airplanes for Boeing or pepperoni sticks for Oberto. It also has a reputation as a cheap place to live. That's changing. We're starting to see prosperity emerge in neighborhoods dogged by poverty and crime. But that prosperity also has a cost, as KUOW's growth and development reporter Joshua McNichols shows us.
We're at a brand new strip mall in the heart of Kent. A truck backs up to a butcher shop. The driver opens the back and pulls out a goat carcass.
What for you?
This butcher doesn't sell beef or pork out of deference to his Hindu and Muslim customers. That's the first of many signs that this is no ordinary strip mall.
This concept, this place, is like my baby. I love it. The way I want it, I'm building it that way.
Sam Virk is building this strip mall for the immigrant community that lives here in Kent, the community that he's a part of. The butcher shop here is just one piece of a bigger project. There's a ballroom people can rent, a boutique that sells custom saris, a Hindu astrologer, an Indian grocery store.
I want to put it a radio station here, this one.
A radio station?
Yes, a radio station, because our Indian community, they don't have a radio station. I may need your help.
Kent is a place where historically, at least in some neighborhoods, low rents have allowed people like Virk and other immigrants to get a toehold, just a toehold on the American dream. It's a dream that has sometimes seemed very far away to Virk. As a young adult, he worked long hours doing things like managing 7-Elevens and driving limousines. One night, his limo got stuck in the snow on the side of the road.
I was praying to the God, so please help me tonight because I was shivering really bad. I had a really bad fever that night, and I was worried about my car gas too. Don't go low because of snow if I stuck, so I cannot turn on the heat.
After 5 hours, the snow got slushy enough that he felt safe driving home. He collapsed on the bed at around 5 a.m., just as his wife rose for her job at the hospital.
That incident, I can't forget it in my life.
But now Sam Virk is a prosperous developer, a big shot around here. Depressed rents and home prices helped him get there, along with hard work and a strong community of immigrant entrepreneurs. And now that community is showing signs of prosperity, and that appears to be driving the rents higher. In fact, rents here have been rising faster than just about every other place in the county. Not everybody can pay those higher rents. At the senior center just down the road, John Werner is playing canasta with a buddy.
It's hard shuffling cards when there are two different sized decks.
There's a dance going on in the room next door. Werner's been living in Kent for the last 3 years.
It's not bad. It's a nice place. The people here are beautiful. They're good people. Some people don't like it, though. They think there's too many rowdies and winos and such, but that's life in the fast lane, I guess.
When Werner moved here, he had a job at a plastics factory and an apartment he could afford. Then the job evaporated, and he lost the apartment. He's looking now for a new place so he can rebuild.
There's a lot of places available, but the question is, can you afford it?
I told Werner about Sam Virk and how Kent's low cost of living helped him get ahead. Werner said times have changed.
You know, there's people out there that own these places, and all they're interested in is the bottom dollar. They don't care if the place is bad or anything, you know.
At his age, Werner says all he needs is a safe, respectable place to sleep.
Something that's clean and decent.
And he hopes to have a little money left over to send to his daughter every month.
She's important. That's all there is left of my life is her.
Werner has some buddies here at the senior center who are in the same situation he's in, and they've hatched a plan. They're going to pool their money and rent a place together. Werner says this plan has kindled a little hope inside of him.
My life is getting brighter by the day. Actually, you know, I'm feeling good about the way things might turn out.
Things are looking up in Kent. Some of the region's expanding wealth is sticking to people who live here, people who faced a lot of obstacles in life. That's a good thing. But as these neighborhoods slowly rise out of poverty, they're becoming less affordable. And unless people get creative and team up with each other, they could get left out in the cold. In Kent, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
That story is part of our Region of Boom project. You can find more stories in the project and tell us about the changes happening in your neighborhood. Those tips, those can help lead us to future stories. So please go to KUOW.org and search for Region of Boom. Now, let's talk more about Seattle neighborhoods then and now. Okay, you know Seattle has the International District. Used to be called Chinatown. Well, there are people here from all kinds of backgrounds. What other ethnic neighborhoods could Seattle have? Community activist Joaquin Garrett has an answer. He grew up in the Central District, where he's watched rising prices squeeze many African-American and African immigrants out of the neighborhood. He wants to build on the Central District's history as Africatown.
Africatown is not something that we're really creating. There's already, you know, the rich African-American history. There's already, you know, East African restaurants and places of worship. There's already, you know, Taste of Caribbean, you know, restaurant, you know. So these assets are already there. And really, we're curating and using that as a baseline to continue to build into the future. And so when you imagine coming into a community and there's a venue where you experience a variety of different musics, whether it's hip hop or reggae or jazz or the Weedle Grooves, funk and soul, or a salsa, and you have, you know, art that is, you know, reflects, again, the diaspora, whether it's the Harlem Renaissance or the Detroit Motown. You know, there's many different experiences that are inspired by these various experiences, regardless of time or geography in the diaspora.
How have you seen the Central District change in your time? You grew up there.
We've seen the community not participate in the growth of Seattle when we look at the technology sectors and the various economic sectors of industry that are growing and bringing more people to Seattle. We've seen that African-American community in the Central District has been one of the communities that has not benefited and grown with that and now is being displaced by that. And so we look at Africatown really being an opportunity to attach the community to innovation economy. We know there's no deficit of innovation in the African-American experience. What Jimi Hendrix did with the guitar, I mean, if that's not innovation, I don't know what it is. So really tapping into that legacy and that heritage of invention, of innovation, of resilience, recreation, and having that be connected to the larger economic opportunities that can have the community grow with the city.
Your heritage is one of business and innovation. Your grandfather was a co-founder of Liberty Bank, first black-owned bank west of the Mississippi. Why was that bank such a big deal for the African-American community?
You know, in a capitalist society, an institution that really helps the flow and distribution of capital in a community is vital. I mean, capital is really kind of the lifeblood in such a society. And so we know that with redlining and the discriminatory practices of the private sector and the public sector, you know, African Americans were denied, you know, access to capital to start businesses, you know, build businesses, buy homes, make home renovations and things of that nature. And so the forming of that institution was one that was really a culmination of moving forward, you know, moving from shadow slavery, where black people were the capital, to being able to grow and develop and be sustainable as a community.
What is your vision of for that property where Liberty Bank used to be?
Yeah, the vision is that there will be a development of affordable housing, and commercial space will be a mitigating factor against the displacement happening from gentrification. So it will help preserve and develop the presence of the African-American community in the Central District.
What are some things the city of Seattle is doing and can do to reverse or mitigate the gentrification, the outflow of African-Americans that's happening and immigrants that's happening in the Central District?
Well, I think we're in a resource-rich region, and it's also Seattle is recognized as one of the most educated cities. So one of the things that the city can do, and I think there are some efforts in this direction, is really harnessing the power of innovation and creative problem solving. We have people here that are working on colonizing Mars, you know, and things of that nature. So I think we can figure out how to support communities right here in our midst and on the ground here on Earth. And I think the city can play a key role as a convener as well as an investor. I think the investment in the development of the Liberty Bank property is a positive step in the direction, looking at how the legacy of arts and culture of the African-American, African diaspora in the Central District can continue to be developed and be a thriving part of the arts and culture ecosystem of Seattle is valuable. I mean, there's a large tourism. And when people come and they look at the maps and they, you know, people see the Troll and they see Chinatown and they want to go and visit Wai Chai Mai, and we need to also have the African-American Africa Town on the map.
If so, if there's an Africa Town in Seattle, what story are we telling people outside our city about us?
Well, I think there's a story of valuing your neighbor, valuing all members of your community. The African-American story in America has been one of resilience in the face of extreme adversity. It's also been one of giving a lot to the social fabric of the city and the society. And I think it's a story of reinvention also. There's a lot of opportunity, and it's a story of innovation. It's a story of it's not just about one community, but about everyone being better. So I think there's an opportunity for those within the African-American community, as well as just the broader Seattle, you know, regional community, to really lift up a part of our family here.
Wyking Garrett is a community activist for Africa Town, an effort to preserve and expand the African-American identity of Seattle's Central District. And you can see a video of the vision for Africa Town. We're tweeting it out right now at KUOW. On KUOW's The Record, I'm Bill Radke. Good afternoon. As the presidential campaign marches on toward New Hampshire, Seattle area voters have a federal election to think about, too. Who will replace 14-term U.S. Congressman Jim McDermott? One candidate is Washington State Senator Pramila Jayapal. She told David Hyde she is an outspoken progressive and that you'll never have to guess where she stands on the issues.
I will never compromise core values, but I try to find the place where there is common ground, and I'm a really great listener. even if we might have very different political beliefs, and I might stand up and have a very, very different take than somebody else on the Senate floor, that people see in me that I'm an honest broker, and they're going to know where I stand, and they're going to know that if there's common ground to be found, I will find it.
So if you're elected, what do you want to do when you get to Congress?
Well, my top priorities really are, first of all, income equality. So looking at women's economic security, minimum wage, paid safe and sick days, gender equity. That's just a hugely important set of issues that I think are at the top of everyone's mind. How are we going to live every day a life of dignity? Secondly, I really want to work on expanding Social Security and Medicare. And then the third is around making sure that our students are not getting saddled with mountains of debt. I think we should be investing in education. We should have tuition-free higher education so that students can go to school and come out and contribute to the workforce.
Washington State is pretty divided, you know, between the east and the western part of the state, between Democrats and Republicans, but the nation seems even more divided right now. And I'm just wondering how you see yourself getting things done in that polarized environment.
I've always believed that being an elected official is not just about stopping bad policy and moving good policy. That's incredibly important. That's a big part of what we do. But it's also about making that connection between the, you know, regular citizenry, residents on the ground, and government. And part of what you've seen is the polarization in part comes because there's not a lot of faith in government. So the people that are making the decisions about who gets elected is so small. It's such a small fraction of everybody that's out there. And I think our job is to start to figure out how we connect the grassroots to policy and to government. And then within that polarized debate, how can we always pull ourselves to the higher level, the higher vision that we're putting forward? You know, right after 9/11, we faced a lot of things similar to what we're facing now with some of, you know, the anti-Muslim language that Trump and others are using. And it required us sort of pulling ourselves out of the mentality of scarcity and fear and really thinking about who we are as a country, what kind of values we have. And when you are an elected official, you have a platform to do that in a very real way. And so that's part of how I think you get above that polarized divisiveness is you put forward a different vision that's bigger than just, you know, some little fear and scarcity thing against some other fear and scarcity thing.
State Senator Pramila Jayapal is with us. She's running to replace Jim McDermott in Congress. And Senator Jayapal, one of your opponents was on KUOW speaking with Bill Radke. This is Joe McDermott, no relationship to Jim McDermott. He serves on the King County Council. And he told Bill that he's backing Hillary Clinton for president in the Democratic primary. Who are you backing?
I'm backing Bernie Sanders because I think Bernie has been consistently talking about the way in which the system has been rigged against working people. And I think that what he is doing and calling out that problem is reminding us that our democracy is not perfect yet. We are striving for the more perfect union. And he is calling into question the fundamental systems that exist. All of that said, I think that in the end, I do believe there's a difference between Democrats and Republicans. And if our nominee is Hillary Clinton at the end, I will jump in and support Hillary Clinton.
Does the fact that you're backing Bernie Sanders signal to voters in the 7th Congressional District that you're a progressive candidate, the most progressive candidate so far declared in this race? What do you think?
Well, there's no question I'm progressive. Nobody has to wonder about that if they look at my record, and nobody has to wonder about whether I'm a bold progressive, which is how I like to describe myself, because I think it's not just about taking the right votes. It's actually about what did you do? What do you do in the field? How do you grow the movement? How do you stand for things when they're hard? How do you push something forward when nobody else wants to do it? That's my track record. Serving, you know, the city of Seattle and the region, the Puget Sound region, for the last 25 years.
Bottom line, why should voters in the greater Seattle area pick you over your declared opponents?
I will tell you that I am a bold progressive who fights hard for the lives and the futures of the people that I represent. And I will take that very seriously. I am incredibly effective. I think I have the strongest track record of actually building movements, not just taking votes. And I will stand up for the things I believe in, but I will always look for the ways forward that are going to move all of us forward together.
A lot of people are familiar with you. They know the name Pramila Jayapal. They might not know you that well. What's something people don't know about you?
I played Jesus when I was in seventh grade in a musical. I used to...
What was the musical?
It was some religious musical that the Baptist church was putting on, and I was brown Jesus, which I think is very appropriate, but back then people thought that was really strange. I think I was the first brown Jesus in that form. But I love to sing and I love to dance. I don't do it as much as I used to, but I've always sung my whole life and played piano and love music.
You'll remember that, right? That's Washington State Senator Pramila Jayapal talking with KUOW's David Hyde. She is running to replace long-term U.S. Congressman Jim McDermott. We are, of course, interviewing all of the candidates for that race, and you'll find all those interviews online at KUOW.org. People of Washington State, you have a new poet laureate, Professor Todd Marshall from Gonzaga University in Spokane. Poet laureate is something you apply for. Marshall told KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman he put his name in because he wanted to advocate for all the arts, not just poetry.
I always have a hard time separating in my head poetry from the other arts and the humanities writ large, because I think that it's really important to find different ways to bring humanities programming to people who might not have access to it. Part of the application process is proposing a project that revolves around just such outreach. And my project is going to involve sharing poems with people because I think that the reception of the arts is an important dynamic, but also encouraging creativity.
Kids paint, mm-hmm. Kids sing. Kids play musical, maybe not well, but they, you know, play blocks and rhythm instruments. They dance. They hear poetry. And then, especially with things like poetry, there seems to be something that happens that disconnects them from any kind of continuity with that joy they found early on. Why?
A couple of things come to mind. I remember one of my first experiences where I realized that I was probably a poesophobe, and that was in high school. And I had a high school English teacher who was teaching us Robert Frost Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though, opening two lines. And I remember him calling on me and asking me about the opening of the poem. I put forth a reading that was connected to thinking about the land ownership in a very literal way. And I remember the teacher saying, "That's wrong. It's talking about God, and his house is the church that's in the village." Now, certainly his take on the poem is one possible arena of meaning. Mine was too. It wasn't necessarily wrong, but it seems like in order to make the teaching of poetry, the teaching of arts in general, measurable for any outcomes dynamic, we take a very reductive approach. That doesn't mean that every poem and every work of art has an unlimited range of meanings. There are only a certain number of possible things that Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening can be about. It's not about the lost city of Atlantis. But I think the more generous and open we are to a range of interpretations, the more inviting we can be for young students of poetry. And I think that's true for all the arts. Anytime that we create barriers that keep people out, you know, we're going to be turning away an audience, or we're going to be shutting down creativity. And that's a sad dynamic.
You teach at Gonzaga, and you are the first of the four poet laureates that we've had so far to live east of the mountains in Spokane. How do you think that geographical locator influences what you write, if at all?
I think place definitely finds its way into art in general. There's no way that you can live among the scab lands of eastern Washington, the incredible basalt columns and the sagebrush tumbling across the desert that is the middle part of our state, or near the Palouse and those incredibly sensual rolling hills, and not have it affect you. Probably through the imagery first and foremost, it finds its way into my work. Our state is incredibly diverse in terms of its terrains. And in Spokane, we're on the edges of several different, different sorts of geographies.
I'm talking to Todd Marshall. He's Washington State's new poet laureate. Poet laureates spend 2 years in the job, and it's a public kind of thing. Your job is to go out and spread the gospel of poetry, right?
That's my job.
You mentioned before I turned on the microphone that you had already had your first gig, your first, not even a commission. You wrote a poem to help celebrate the signing of a bill in Spokane. And I'm wondering how that sort of public performance of Poet Laureate, how that compares to the way that you normally go about the business of making art.
It was very different. To be honest, I am a fairly slow producer. There are pretty wide gaps between my books in terms of the number of years, and I don't imagine that's going to change. But I thought it was important to, when called upon, produce. And so I thought that putting aside some of those romantic and idealistic notions, sequestering myself away, in the smoky garret, was something that I could abandon for a little while in order to produce. I think that it shows people that poetry might be a little less precious than the last few centuries have made it out to be. And that's an important thing to illustrate.
Todd Marshall, what do you love so much about poetry?
That's a really hard question to answer because there are so many different ways that I love poetry, I suppose. I love T.S. Eliot and the intellectual challenge that he provides. I love William Carlos Williams and his playfulness and his, kind of scoffing at academia. I love Emily Dickinson's and, diving into the depths of psychology, Whitman's expansiveness. I love listening to as many different types of poetry as I can encounter because to shut off one of those ways that poetry can connect with us seems not particularly generous.
That is your new state poet laureate, Todd Marshall, with KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman. Marshall officially becomes the state poet laureate next Tuesday at a reading at Seattle's Richard Hugo House. You can hear a couple of Todd Marshall's poems at our website. One of them is called Three Dreams from the East Side of the Mountains. It is a tour de force. He used the word sensual to describe it. That's a good word. I really recommend it. And we're tweeting it out right now at KUOW. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. A sci-fi favorite from the 90s is back on TV. Do I have to say any more? The X-Files starred FBI agents Dana Scully and Fox Mulder exploring the paranormal. The first 5 seasons were filmed in Vancouver and other spots in British Columbia. Pop culture columnist Kim Linnikin with CBC Radio says the X-Files put Vancouver on the map as a destination for making TV shows and films, leading to the nickname Hollywood North. She told me what the film and TV scene was like in Vancouver before the X-Files came to town.
Generally, we had a lot of kind of cheesy movies of the week, so it was sort of this kind of embarrassed film and TV industry. We were working hard, but we were working on the crap that America didn't want to have shot in America, so it was a little bit embarrassing. And then the X-Files came, and that really was a boost of confidence to everybody, especially when it became a hit. It wasn't expected to be a hit, and suddenly it was.
And how did that change Vancouver's film and TV industry?
It made us the niche for sci-fi. So after that, TV shows like Stargate started filming here. Smallville shot here. Battlestar Galactica was kind of a coup for us. Fringe and Supernatural, which is still shooting here 11 years later. And now it's kind of gotten to the point where if it's a sci-fi TV show or a supernatural show or even a superhero show, why isn't it shot in Vancouver? Pretty much all of them are shot in Vancouver. Arrow and The Flash, Once Upon a Time is shot here. It was just filming in my local park the other day. Pretty much every zombie show is shot here. So it's just given such a boost of confidence to the industry and really made it quite an attraction for Hollywood, I think, not just because it's cheap, but because we've got this niche down.
And how much credit do you give to the X-Files for birthing all that shooting?
We have to give a lot of credit to it because I think because it came about in the 90s when, you know, the golden age of television was just starting, and the X-Files was a great breeding ground for behind-the-scenes talent. The people who worked on the X-Files as writers went on to create Homeland, went on to create The Breaking Bad, and, you know, really spun off into all these. And they kept their love for Vancouver a little bit, so they brought some of their other shows to be shot here. So I think it really hit upon so many great things, not just showing off Vancouver as a great location, and all the geeks growing up in the 90s who have shows now want to come back to Vancouver because of the X-Files. So we have to give it a lot of credit. And, you know, we'll even give David Duchovny some credit, even though he kind of pooped on our city a little bit there.
You know, we get the otherworldly sci-fi vampires Twin Peaks thing here in Washington State, too. Why do you think that is a thing in the Pacific Northwest that we share?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, David Duchovny made fun of the fact that it's like 400 inches of rain per day in Vancouver, but the rainy, moody atmosphere and certainly the woods that are everywhere in the Northwest and in the lower mainland of BC here, that's the attraction. And the fact that you have kind of mountains in the distance, it's just a moody, spooky atmosphere. And there are so many other types of things around that you can still make use of. I mean, Vancouver's skyline can really substitute for pretty much any major city. It substitutes for New York in the TV show Suits quite well. So it's kind of got everything. But I think what you're hitting on is just like the rain, which you'd think would make it harder to shoot up here, but for some reason it's an attraction.
And you guys in Vancouver have stolen work from the Seattle area, haven't you?
Well, yeah, sorry about that, but, we'll take the work where we can get it. So there's been movies like Twilight. The first one was shot in the Washington area, but the second and third ones were shot in Vancouver. Sorry about that. And then we also got 50 Shades of Grey recently, where I think the Space Needle was seen in green screen as opposed to the real thing. And The Killing, the TV show about murders in and around Seattle, it was shot entirely here. So, it's the same weather and a lot of the same looking streets, so we'll take your work where we can get it.
Okay, well, all is forgiven. Speaking of stealing work, Kim, the X-Files late in their run actually left Vancouver and they moved down to Los Angeles. What was that like when the X-Files split?
Well, it was a disappointment, but I got to say there was a bit of, schadenfreude, because the show itself went downhill right as soon as they left Vancouver. So we like to take a bit of responsibility for that the show was only good while it was in Vancouver. So I think that's one of the reasons that the X-Files have come back again, because they're trying to capture the nostalgia people feel for the earlier seasons, the better seasons.
You might be joking, but do you think the X-Files lost a little of that gloomy Northwest weird when it started going to Los Angeles?
They've admitted that. They said they just couldn't recapture that. I mean, all they had was arid desertscapes for their weirdness in the later seasons, and that just didn't quite cut it. They lost the moodiness that comes with mist and fog and forests. So I think they have admitted that.
That's Kim Linnikin, pop culture columnist for CBC Radio. We talked to her in Vancouver, where she lives. We talked to her because The X-Files is back for a 6-episode run Monday nights on Fox. So, we were just talking about the moody, the spooky atmosphere of the greater Pacific Northwest. Let's bring in Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hey, Vaughn.
The truth is still out there.
X-Files fan, Vaughn?
I just watched the new episode the other night. You sort of sit there as a British Columbian and try to spot the scenes. It'll say Portland or Seattle or some other place, and you go, gee, that really looks like Stanley Park to me.
So there's a
tour company in Vancouver. I don't know if they're still in business, but they used to offer tours of famous X-Files sites in and around Vancouver. So big fans. It's a little like the walking tours you can get in Forks of all the vampire sites.
It's
a pretty big thing. And you did refer to the fact that the company at one point complained about Vancouver, how wet it was, and
yes,
gloomy and depressing. And a lot of us say, well, isn't that the point of your character? I mean, are you supposed to be gloomy and depressing and half suicidal? What do you think the atmosphere is all about out there?
Well, let's talk about the politics of preserving those moody, spooky woods, those forests,
yeah.
Vaughn, because here we have the Great Bear Rainforest, huge. It's essentially the whole Pacific coast of British Columbia, and BC has apparently decided what to do with it. What's happening?
Yeah, it's been a fight for a long, long time, 20 years, to try to get this deal put together. We're talking about an area that goes from maybe 100, 150 miles north of Vancouver all the way to the Alaska Panhandle, valley after valley. I think there's something like 70 pristine watersheds here. And a deal finally announced this week, as I said, after off and on negotiations lasted almost 20 years, to preserve most of it. There will be a bit of logging going on there, not a lot. Most of it's preserved. A lot of the people that live there, mostly Native Canadians, will have some access to the land base. But basically what you've got is this area. I think it's the size of Belgium, if that means anything to you. Mm. It's about 7.5 million acres, mostly preserved. It is, my favorite detail about it is that back when they started the negotiations, this area was known as the Mid-Coast Timber Supply Area by the BC government, which tells you how they viewed it. You know,
right, resource
of timber.
Yes.
It is now the Great Bear Rainforest. So talk about the impact you can get, Bill, with branding. The environmentalists who came up with that name, the Great Bear Rainforest, credit that change of name to a lot of their success in getting the area preserved.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah, it's known for grizzlies, of course, but also the white bear, the spirit bear, which apparently is sometimes these black bears are born with a white coat.
That's right. The official animal of British Columbia is that very bear, the spirit bear. It is a freak of nature, in fact, and some people think it's appropriate that that's the official animal of British Columbia, since it can be pretty weird.
Yes, yes. Anybody opposed to this deal, or is it getting nothing but love?
There's some grumbling. People in the forest industry think that way too much timber has been preserved, and it'll cost jobs, but the industry's pretty much adapted to it. Some environmentalists think that there's still too much logging going on, and there is some grumbling that limited amount of grizzly bear hunting will be allowed in the region. It has not been turned into a complete park. It's not officially a park. It's preserved wilderness. So there will be some hunting going on. So, yeah, there's some grumbling on it at the margins, but I think, Bill, people recognize that these negotiations, as I say, took nearly 20 years. There's a lot of feeling that this is an amazing accomplishment, and 85% of it will not be touched at all, and limited amount of activity in the other.
We've been talking about limited logging, a lot of preservation in this home to cougars and wolves and salmon and grizzlies and white bears and thousand-year-old western red cedars.
And space aliens, Bill,
and
if you've
space
been following
aliens.
The X-Files.
That's right, yeah. To bring it all back home. That's Vaughn Palmer from the Vancouver Sun. Always good to talk with you, Vaughn. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Bill.
On KUOW's The Record, producer Amina Al-Saadi. We're tweeting, of course, at KUOW, Facebooking KUOW Public Radio. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in.